Support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT. Tom Stoppard returns to ACT with Indian Ink, direct from its sold-out run in New York. Limited performances run January 14th through February 8th at the Geary Theater. ACT-SF.org.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Over the last decade, innovations in 3D printing, bionics, and other technologies have led to significant improvements in the form and function of prosthetics. It's more common these days to see amputees dancing, rock climbing, and showing off custom-designed limbs. In this hour of Forum, we check in on the changing world of prosthetics and what effect, if any, it's having on our understanding of what it means to be disabled. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. From mechanical legs with custom skins and ankles that can be adjusted for the heel heights of different shoes, to bionic arms with motors and microchips that can replicate natural motion, artificial limbs or prosthetics have become increasingly sophisticated technologically over the last decade and more personalized. Some people prefer sleek chrome limbs, others leather or wood. Still others want intricate patterns or graphics. Nearly 2 million Americans have experienced amputations or were born with limb difference, according to the Amputee Coalition, including those returning from war or who lost limbs in the recent Boston Marathon bombings. So what effect are these advances in prosthetics having on people's lives? Joining us to talk about this is Dan Bershinsky, an Afghanistan war veteran and chairman of the Amputee Coalition. Dan Bershinsky, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks. Happy to have you. And we're also joined by Emily Smith-Badix, Assistant Director of the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you so much.
And Scott Summit joins us. He's Director of Technology for Bespoke Products.
Actually, Design Director for 3D Systems now.
Oh, I'm sorry. You have a new title. Congratulations. Scott, you know, I know that one of your goals as an industrial designer has been to make sort of perfectly fitted, custom, useful, and also attractive prosthetics. But I just wouldn't mind if you could tell us, what have prosthetics been like traditionally?
Traditionally, it has been driven mainly by utility, where it is an assembly of parts that are mechanical in nature. Pylons and fittings and mounts and machine titanium parts that are bolted together. It's very sophisticated from the biomechanical perspective, but they really have not put a lot of attention into the design of it. So it doesn't really reflect the human form. It looks more like a fitting of mechanical parts.
Dan Bershinsky, you've described plain prosthetics in the past as, quote, crappy. What did you mean by that?
Well, so I'm a user. I'm a bilateral above-knee amputee, and the choices that amputees are offered are pretty limited. We live in times of really advanced technology. Everyone's showing off the latest gear from automobiles to cell phones to computers, and yet the legs, which I use and every other amputee uses on a daily basis and pretty much for as long as that amputee is alive, they're going to be using their prostheses. And my legs are what they are. They come in a box, and then there is no way to change their appearance. There's some new endeavors on the market that are starting to address that, but every day I strap on my legs, and it's an assemblage of titanium and aluminum and some carbon fiber and some little plastic covers, and that's it, and it is what it is.
And I want to talk more about that technology that you're talking about, where it's moving to. And Scott, I know that you have worked with clients that made you realize that prosthetics needed to move in a new direction. Could you share some stories and talk about what you did for them?
Yeah, we really wanted to augment the prosthetic limb, not to take any of the functionality away, not to make it any less pragmatic, but really to add a bit of humanity into the design of it. So we would we started a process where we three-dimensionally scan the person's soundside limb, if it does exist. We 3D scan that, and then on the computer, we mirror that data to recreate body symmetry. So now we have reference geometry on our computer that is a facsimile of the leg that was lost. And then from there, we work with the client and design something that we call a fairing, which is a part that will then attach to the titanium substructure. But it will be designed. So it might have a pattern. It might have leather. It might be chrome plated. It might have anything that really reflects that person's personality and the way they want to see this new part of their body, so that it's no longer simply a rudimentary utilitarian part, but it expresses them much the way, for example, fashion eyewear reflects somebody's sense of taste more than it reflects the medical condition that they are addressing.
And you developed this through interaction with clients, right? Do you remember a client that sort of helped you move in this direction?
We started this on a hunch that there was this interest, and I started working with a few clients in this area. One of the women, she was a runner, and so she had a really great physique, but she hadn't worn a shorter skirt in years because she just didn't like the attention. And so we 3D printed a leg for her and wrapped it in quilted leather and chrome plated details and things like that. And all of a sudden she liked the attention, and she got very excited because people started approaching her and telling her that that was the coolest thing they've seen all day. And she started texting me that she was getting the kind of attention she wanted, not the kind of curious, morbid attention that she had been used to.
And this was all done, as you said, using 3D printing.
We use 3D printing as the mainstay technology because when you are talking about creating a single part for a single person and one that is highly complex, inevitably, 3D printing is really your only option because there just aren't traditional processes that are going to get you there.
And I understand that we have photos of your work on our website of some of the artificial limbs that you created. You know, it reminds me, Dan Brzezinski, of something that you've also said where it was that right now there seems to be more of a movement about it being cool to let your hardware show, that that people have little desire for the artificial limb to look human and that they're no longer trying to. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, well, at the Amputee Coalition, we actually started an initiative last year. It's a social media initiative called Show Us Your Metal. It's a play on words, of course. And what we asked was, we asked our constituents to, you know, show us in your day-to-day lives, take pictures of you out and about and showing off your limbs and not being embarrassed, not trying to hide them. And that's really indicative of what I've seen as a user, as a member of this population. I've been an amputee for just over 5 years now, so I'm still relatively young in that regard. But what I've seen is the population really isn't trying to hide the limbs anymore. Most users are not covering them up in the traditional foam and latex covers that are supposed to look exactly like human legs, but never really quite get there. And instead, we're embracing the technology. The legs that I'm wearing at this very moment are composed of carbon fiber, titanium. There's a microprocessor inside. There's a gyroscope and a force load sensor. They're really quite advanced. And I think this is really indicative of a greater trend in our society that we really do embrace technology, all forms of technology these days. And prosthetic limbs are just another form of this technology. We've all seen recently some pretty cool commercials around the Paralympics, Wounded Warrior Project maybe, where athletes are wearing these really neat looking cheetah blades and they're running and jumping and being very active. And that is just an example of the community as a whole really not trying to hide the disability anymore and instead embracing it.
And by embracing it, what changes are you seeing? Are you seeing personal transformations?
I think so. So I don't want to speak for everybody. Again, I'm young in the community, but so I was injured in Afghanistan in 2009. I was fortunate enough to do several years of rehabilitation at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., which has become the flagship rehabilitation and surgical center for traumatic amputations, unfortunately. But I did rehabilitation surrounded by hundreds of other soldiers and Marines. And so, you know, the guys, mostly the men and women, are young and athletic and outgoing, and not a single one of them was interested in pulling on a handmade, very expensive, time-consuming, but handmade latex cover that is supposed to look like a human leg or a human arm, but never really does. Instead, they say, you know what? This is a robotic leg. I'd actually like to throw some extra accents on there. How can I make it look even more robotic? Let's just embrace this aesthetic and roll with it. And that's definitely something that I've seen personally.
Do you think this sort of show your hardware is also changing society? I mean, do you think that it's also, besides having an effect on the individual, that it's also changing maybe society's perception of disability?
I think so. I think when people with disabilities are out and about living their lives nowadays, I think there is a little less hesitation for the, for lack of better word, for the regular public to come up and engage with them. You know, it's like, hey, that is a really cool wheelchair. I've never seen anything like that before. Can you tell me about it? That's a really cool arm. I've never seen a prosthetic arm like that before. Can you tell me about it? And that is from a disabled person's perspective, I think that is really cool because I'm not trying to hide anything. I couldn't hide it even if I wanted to. And so I understand that it's different. I was perfectly healthy, a normal person for 25 years until I was wounded in combat. And I remember having questions and just not really knowing how to interact with people with disabilities. And nowadays, at least, if you see someone with some really cool technology and they're showing it off, you know, that is a starting point to a conversation that allows you to get to know that person. And the whole point is to move beyond the disability and recognize that these are people. First and foremost, these are people living productive, normal lives. And if you can start to talk to them about, man, is that really made out of carbon fiber? That opens up a conversation and then you actually get to know that person and you just move beyond the disability instead of staying focused on it. And I think overall, that's a very positive thing.
We're talking with Dan Brzezinski, an Afghanistan war veteran and chairman of the Amputee Coalition. Also, Scott Summit. He is design director for 3D products. And Emily Smith-Batix of the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability. And Emily Batix, one of the things that I've heard you say is that we treat technology too often as a silver bullet, but it's not. Do you think we are overhyping the possibilities that exist with these new technologies?
Well, I think you have to factor in and always be asking the question, how do we define success here? And I think that technological success is not always equal to what success will be for the end user. I think that it's a wonderful move that some people are very excited to show off their metal and have more high-tech prostheses. And I also think that there's some people that are going to run the other way and want to just not have any prosthetic at all, and that we have to make room for the range of possibilities because it's really not that different than, you know, the fact that I don't have a smartphone yet, and some people are like shocked by that. If we're going to attach this device to our body so intimately and so heavily rely upon it, we need to make room in the conversation for, you know, what the best technology is for you and your lifestyle. And sometimes these high-tech prosthetics, very, very impressive technologically and very important that they're out there and developed and offered, but they may not be right for everyone. And when there's such a price tag attached to them, it's also very tricky to talk about because there's so many people with disabilities who don't have access to very basic devices.
And so that brings up the question of cost and accessibility. Dan Brzezinski, what does your hardware cost?
I am actually not entirely certain. I have the tremendous fortune to be, for the rest of my life, to be taken care of by our government and by the active duty military medical system, as well as the Veterans Affairs medical system. So to tell you the truth, I actually don't know what all my procedures and all of my hardware costs. I have absolutely no doubt that the military has spent $1 million easily on my recovery and will continue to spend quite handsomely for the rest of my life. A rough estimate of the legs that I wear right now, these are Ottobock X3 the latest generation from this rather large manufacturer. I think they cost around $60,000 is the number that's been thrown around to me. And so I'm wearing two of them. And that does not take into account all of the other parts and custom handmade sockets that actually serve as the interface between my body and the knee joints themselves.
Mm. So it could be much more than that.
Yes. The whole package is a good bit more, I would say.
Scott Summitt, what about your – what would you say is the price range for somebody going to you with for a 3D printed limb?
Yeah, when we do the pharynx are not the entire limb. They are simply an augment to it, and they recreate body symmetry and give it a sense of design, as Dan was alluding to before. The process that we do is $4,000 for a basic one with polymer altogether. And then when you add augments like metal or leather, things like that, it'll be six.
I see. And, you know, 3D printing, I've felt like in terms of reading all the different possibilities of technologies out there, sort of seemed to represent almost like a middle ground. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, where it sort of exists in this technological landscape that we're hearing so much about?
Well, 3D printing is a very versatile technology, and it's new enough that a lot of people don't quite understand where it fits. And there's a lot of defining still to be done. Right now, a prosthetic limb is done the traditional way with titanium and carbon fiber and all the parts that Dan was mentioning. But it is such a versatile technology that I can imagine that before long, we're going to see more and more 3D printed parts for any number of reasons, either because a socket is made very well this way, because it creates a complex part for a single person very well, or because in the case of 3D printed hands, which a company called Enable is creating right now, you can dramatically reduce the cost of a hand and get a high degree of functionality for under $100, maybe under $50 sometimes, to create a hand that would otherwise have cost several thousand. So there are a lot of opportunities that 3D printing represents when you're talking about prosthetic limbs and other prosthetic devices. But a lot of them are in development. It is a nascent technology. In some regards, and it has a really exciting future ahead of it.
So what are some of the challenges with 3D printing?
Some of the challenges are that the FDA doesn't know quite what to make of it because it is new enough on the field, it's new enough player that they're trying to get their heads around it. Traditional medicine does not quite know what to do with it because traditional medicine does things in the way they have been for a long time. They are reluctant to try the latest thing until it's been absolutely proven. So there are a number of hurdles that we have to get over before it becomes commonplace for everyone to enjoy.
And what's the difference between 3D printing or 3D printed devices and bionics?
Bionics are going to be powered devices. And sometimes they work together. For example, you could have 3D printed parts on a bionic exoskeleton. And that's something that we did as a collaborative effort with ExoBionics over here in Point Richmond. Bionics are intelligent powered devices that will augment human motion. And they might be used for a fully able-bodied person to augment their strength. Or they might be used for a paraplegic or hemiplegic person to give them the walking or the stability or whatnot that they've lost.
And I understand we have Michael Goldfarb on the line. He's professor of mechanical engineering at Vanderbilt University Center for Intelligent Mechatronics. Professor Goldfarb, I understand your team developed the first robotic prosthesis with both powered knee and ankle joints. Can you talk to us about how your artificial leg works? Mr. Goldfarb?
Sure. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can now. Thank you.
Okay. So how the it's a robotic leg, and if you look at typical prostheses, they are what we call energetically passive devices, which means they don't have the equivalent of muscles, and because they don't have the equivalent of muscles, people walk more slowly and need more energy to get from point A to point B, and have difficulty walking on. Generally walking on anything but fairly level terrain, and they fall a lot, and they seek medical attention as a result of those falls a lot, and they incur a lot of overuse injuries on their intact joints. And so robotics within the past, let's say about 5 years, have advanced to the point where you can start to put muscles back into the prosthetic leg. And if you have muscles in the leg, then I think you can probably pretty obviously better reproduce the functionality of the missing limb. So that's what we've been doing for the past roughly maybe 7 years or so. And the leg has, a knee and an ankle that, again, has the equivalent of muscles and has microcontrollers and sensors on it that really play the equivalent role of what the central nervous system would in a healthy limb. And then obviously maybe some batteries that play the equivalent role of what the metabolic power supply would in a healthy person. And using all the sensors, the microcontroller, the leg figures out what it is that the person using it wants it to do. So it kind of infers real time whether the person wants to walk level ground more slowly or more quickly or go up slopes or down slopes or upstairs or downstairs or sit or stand or ride a bicycle. And then it kind of performs the right kind of function for them.
And has your device been approved by the FDA? We were just talking with Scott Summitt about some of the hurdles related to the FDA.
Yeah, it hasn't yet. We are, number one, a research lab, and so we have licensed our technology to outside companies, and outside company, and they're in the process of bringing it to market, and that process will take a couple of years and will require FDA approval. The studies to gain that approval have not yet been done.
And Professor Goldbach, thank you so much for sharing your device. We'd love to talk with you a little bit more, but it seems that the line is a little bit tricky here, so we'll probably have to let you go. But look forward to learning more about your devices. Just curious really quickly, if someone wanted to buy it, what would it cost?
Well, I don't think the price is established yet. I think there's legitimate concern about rising cost of healthcare and prosthetics, but I don't think one needs to conflate increased functionality with increased cost. I assume that it would be competitive with current devices that are on the market. That's what I understand based on conversations with the company.
Well, Professor Goldfarb, thanks so much.
Yes, thank you.
We're talking with Dan Bershinsky, an Afghanistan war veteran and chairman of the Amputee Coalition, Emily Smith-Batix of the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability, and Scott Summitt. He is director of 3D Systems. And we also just spoke with Michael Goldfarb, professor of mechanical engineering at Vanderbilt University. We're talking about the advances in prosthetics. And if you'd like to join the discussion, please give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And just with this, before we go to the break, very quickly, I wanted to ask you, Scott Summitt, I know that you said your technology is a little bit less and it's not exactly a limb, but is it true that the machines can cost tens of thousands of dollars and still turn out misprinted copies at this point, or has the technology gotten a lot better related to your...
3D printing is a pretty varied technology. It's an umbrella technology, or an umbrella term covering a lot of technologies. The higher-end industrial machines that we use a lot of are very, very reliable, and we get very predictable results.
Thanks. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. We're talking about advances in prosthetics and their effect on amputees or people living with disabilities. I'm Mina Kim. Our guests are Dan Bershinsky, an Afghanistan war veteran and chairman of the Amputee Coalition, Emily Smith-Batix of the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability, and Scott Summitt, design director at 3D Systems. I'd like to go now to Ian Stevens. He's with Touch Bionics. Hi, Ian. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. I understand that you have a device called the iLimb that is actually focused on arm and hand limbs. Can you talk a little bit about your technology and what it does?
Sure, yeah. The iLimb is a bionic hand. So for those people who've been unfortunate enough to lose a hand, and it's connected to the body. There's five individually moving digits, and it's very useful for someone because it replaces functions that may have been lost. Of course, it's a very big deal to lose a limb.
And I understand working on hands is far more complicated in some ways than on legs. Is that right? And what are some of those complications?
Well, I would say it's different. The lower limbs are more powerful, and so you're essentially pushing off the ground all the time. With the hands, with the upper limbs, then it's more intricate. We use our hands, of course, for so many detailed tasks. So it's just a different way of having to use them.
And did you say that you can tether the hand to a smartphone?
We can, yeah. I mean, the normal way that the hand works is that you have electrodes placed on the surface of maybe the forearm if someone's had an amputation near to their wrist. And those electrodes pick up little signals from the muscles, and then a processor in the hand will move the fingers. And that's the normal way. But then we have an app, and so for other functions, you can just press a button on the app and the hand will move into that mode. Maybe you want to grip something, pinch something, use a point of finger at a keyboard so you can type on a keyboard. It's just a quick way to do those things. Apps are good for that, aren't they?
And I understand the cost of the iLimb is $80,000 to about $120,000. Is that right?
Well, it can be. It's quite expensive. That's what happens is that it's generally covered by some sort of insurance for the patient, and the prosthetist fits the iLimb and then insurance covers that, hopefully.
While I have you on the line, could you respond to an email from Frank who writes, why is anyone talking about $100,000 arms? Hardly anyone who needs one could ever afford it, or even decent non-electronic prosthetics. There's a disconnect between the wealthy people who surely have all their limbs and posh homes whose thinking mired in venture capital la-la land versus the veterans and accident victims who have no legs and have no money. What would you say to that about it? What would you say to Frank?
I think that actually there's a lot of availability of these sort of prosthetics. Medicare and workers' compensation insurance and other insurance providers do cover these things. I mean, they do provide an extraordinary amount of replaced mobility for someone who's generally had a really serious traumatic event, and so for someone to be able to tie their shoelaces, feed themselves, pull up their pants. It's a big deal. And my company and other companies in prosthetics make sure that we put a huge amount of research into trying to make these things as useful as possible.
Well, Ian Stevens, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
All right. It's a pleasure.
Dan Brzezinski, I want to put the same Frank's question to you as well. Do you think that we should really be talking about $100,000 arms?
I think we absolutely should. I understand Frank's sentiment. I think he's a little bit cynical, and I'll explain why. One, thankfully, at least in this country, our veterans actually are receiving access to pretty much the top level of care that is possible. The government spares no expense for the legs and the arms that our veterans deserve, and so that's a very good thing. Unfortunately, that is not the case across the broad spectrum of American amputees. Medicare does a reasonable job, but especially in the opinion of the Amputee Coalition, it could be improved quite a bit. And I think what we're kind of bumping up against is an age-old debate about philosophy, which is how do you take care of the injured and the sick? Unfortunately, we live in a world that is ruled by finance and bean counters. And there is a debate about should we outlay a bunch of money to heal people and help people recover, or should we, just to cut to the point, should we cut our losses and leave them on their own? That's a much larger topic of debate here in America. But I would say that while the price of this technology can be quite shocking, $100,000 for a hand, $60,000 for a leg, when you put that on a person and give an American their independence back, their ability to get up and walk into work, to stand behind a desk, to type at a keyboard, that person is no longer sitting at home being unproductive, They are a part of the workforce. Perhaps they're creating jobs. And so in the long run, the net benefit to society is tremendously positive. And that's something that we just like to remind people and really to remind insurance and medicine in general, is that the upfront cost may be high, but over the lifetime, the cost really is quite not substantial, not at all.
Dan Brzezinski is an Afghanistan war veteran and chairman of the Amputee Coalition. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Are you an amputee? What's your ideal prosthetic? One that blends in or one that reflects your personality? Or what are your thoughts on the power of technology to transform people's lives? You can email your questions or comments as well as call us. You can email them to forum at kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Emily Batix, you know, you've mentioned that people need good assistive technology to function to the best of their abilities. But do you feel like there is too much money going into sort of research and development of bionics and more needs to go towards other things?
Well, I think the challenge is that it's cast as either or, you know, that we get so caught up in these excited ones that they get so much the research money. And, you know, I'm reminded of Patty Byrne with Sins Invalid, who mentions in a wonderful film called Fix that's all about this topic. And, you know, she says it's so frustrating to see so many of these stories on the media about these high tech expensive devices, and I still don't have a wheelchair that's waterproof that can go out in the rain, you know. It doesn't have to be either or so much as making sure that the devices that people who, you know, don't have incredible insurance are also still meeting basic functions and being developed in a way that can be sustainable for people. And also just keeping in mind that, you know, some people are really excited about the high tech, but others, that's exactly what makes them very uncomfortable. They're tired of already being seen as monsters, or, you know, as being called cyborgs. And so a really high tech device is what's very scary to them and not appealing. I'm thinking of a disability studies scholar, Simi Linton, who's a wheelchair writer, and talked about when she switched over to high tech electric power wheelchair. She said it felt like Bob Dylan going to the electric guitar. You know, it's a tough call that people have to make, and we need to make sure that we're not just getting so excited about the fancy, sexier items, and we're also keeping in mind, you know, what everyday, more practical items are looking like for people.
What about the sentiment that some people have shared? Because I'm familiar with Fixed, what you're talking about is that the focus on technology can focus so much more on the individual that it actually can undermine a need to change the built environment. Do you agree with that sentiment?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, when you keep saying the power of tech to transform people's lives, and technology has done wonderful things for disabled community and people with disabilities, but technology is never going to do everything. And we also need to get really excited about technologies like elevators that can, you know, open up environment and change something that doesn't put the focus on the individual body. It, you know, now makes a change in the environment that everyone can use and benefit from, you know, rather than exoskeletons where somebody will ideally be able to climb upstairs, or, you know, high-tech wheelchairs that can climb stairs. Focusing on ways that we can make our environment more inclusive and fighting stigma. And it's exciting to have the conversation, so much of it today, be about personalization as a way to fight stigma. And that's part of it. But it shouldn't just come from cool technology. It also just has to come from wider cultural conversations about the fact that we see disability as tragic and pitiful, and there's so many better ways to see disability as a creative and generative force, as disability can open new doors for people.
And just very quickly, examples of ways to change the built environment.
I mean, trying to develop more inclusive environments that think about universal design, that think about, you know, the example of you put in a curb cut and all of a sudden you have not just people with disabilities benefiting from it, but parents with strollers and homeless people pushing carts and the wheelie suitcases. You change the environment and it can often, you know, be useful for way more people. Now, with prosthetics, it's not quite as simple as that. You know, it's not as easy to say, oh, well, there's this change that you can make that then makes it not matter that you don't have the use of your fingers, although sometimes it certainly can be, you know, larger buttons, for example, so that you don't have to have the dexterity to push a tiny button. You could use a stump if that's what you prefer, and that could still allow you to open a door or get in a elevator.
Wendy from San Francisco writes, I wonder if someone with bad knees, instead of undergoing knee replacement surgery, which often leads to MRSA and other antibiotic-resistant infections, if they could get a prosthetic or exoskeleton knee rather than have surgery. Scott, can you address that?
I can't speak to that right now. I don't know of a knee that would provide that kind of augment. Just that's not our area of focus. But ExoBionics over in Point Richmond is doing some really amazing stuff in that general area of assistive technology. And they might be the first place to look.
And what's interesting is that Wendy's point raises that this kind of technology isn't necessarily only for people who have lost limbs, right? It can also be for people who may have all their limbs but are looking to enhance their abilities.
There are Exo's working on, for example, construction equipment that assists construction workers and any number of things. Hemiplegia is another one for stroke victims, where the device will not just be tailored to somebody who has no motion, but who has partial motion. So the robot can be very highly programmed to a specific person's individual needs.
And let's go to some of your calls. Let's go to Rich in Burlingame. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I'll take the answer offline. Can you please ask Scott if he's used 3D printing to create sockets for above-the-knee amputees? Scott, you'll know that fitting, customizing, and building the sockets is a long, painful process. Ill-fitting sockets cause chafing, pain, continuous pain when you're wearing your prosthetic, and a good-fitting socket is really as important as the prosthetic leg itself. And I think rapid development of sockets would be fantastic. Thank you.
That's a great question, and I couldn't agree more. I've been working on that for a number of years, and I know that Walter Reed is working on it as well, and a number of other companies are looking into that. 3D printing is a natural candidate for creating sockets. It's a part of an overall process that involves 3D scanning and then actually some haptic manipulation sometimes of that data. But 3D printing is a great candidate for sockets. It hasn't been approved yet. It's not in standard practice. But I would say give it a few years and it will be the norm for that.
Rich, thanks so much for the call. And, you know, the other question that I had for you, Scott, is that I understand you're not just looking at limbs, but you're looking towards scoliosis next?
One of our big emphasis areas is scoliosis because it is a compliance-based treatment where the girl, it's largely girls, going through puberty, they have to willingly wear a brace that currently they can't stand wearing. So even though the brace is known to be effective when it's worn, the challenge is the entire treatment hinges on an 8-year-old girl doing something she's determined not to do. So our goal is to rewrite the equation where we 3D scan her body, design the brace, but design it through the lens of a fashion designer so that it's a beautiful thing. It has a pattern so that her skin breathes. She's very comfortable. It's very discreet, so it's invisible under a T-shirt. She can hide it. But also the pattern itself looks beautiful, and she gets to choose it from a library of patterns that we have. So to her, it's a fashion device that happens to have a medical component to it, as opposed to being a medical device that's been imposed into her life for a number of years. It's all as an effort to get her to wear that brace more, because if she wears it longer, her likelihood of a successful outcome is that much increased.
And it's interesting, you're actually wearing sort of an arm or wrist brace. Can you describe what you're wearing? Because it's something that you made through 3D printing, correct?
I am, yeah. We call this playing with our food. I have a torn ligament in my wrist, and I went under general surgery, general anesthetic and full surgery around Thanksgiving. But I don't like the idea of wearing the fiberglass cast that was the default cast that I would have awakened with. So I 3D scanned my arm right before surgery, and we designed this brace, and we call it the bikini brace because it's as minimal as it can possibly be. It has enough structure to isolate motion on my hand and to grip against my forearm and to grip against my upper arm because it has to resist rotation. But aside from that, there's very, very little material. So the wound, the surgical site is open, so I can put hot and cold compresses on it. I can massage the wound site so that the scar tissue doesn't accumulate. The doctor visit, instead of being a difficult operation where I had to go in and get it buzzsawed off and then cleaned and then a new one wrapped up, I simply rolled up my sleeve. The doctor looked at the surgical site and said, it looks great. And then we talked for a while and I left. It reduced an hour and a half process to about 5 minutes.
And again, we have pictures of Scott Summit's work on our website. Emily Batix, you know, we've been talking a little bit about people who are not amputees, who are wearing artificial or enhancements, technological enhancements, I guess, is the better way to put it. Do you think that this has the potential to change people's attitudes toward people with disabilities or any stigma that might exist?
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think if you think about the history of eyeglasses, it's very similar, where all of a sudden, because you see this branching out in this industry boom around the product, then we don't think of, you know, having bad eyesight as a disability anymore, unless it becomes sort of a vision impairment. So I think it certainly can help. But I think it's also such a bigger project to fight stigma. I think that when we celebrate it around the devices that get attached, we still forget about the people that aren't going to have those really sexy, cool devices and, you know, might still have something that looks medical because that's all their insurance will cover. Because, you know, often the personalized things, I mean, even adding a color to a wheelchair can make it not qualify for insurance because it's now seen as not a medical necessity, a medical device anymore. It's seen as a product. So there's risks too in making the devices so cool when people need basic access and the way that the current structure and system works.
Scott, are you working with, say, like Medicare or Medicaid on trying to get these things covered by insurance more?
Yeah. Well, we work with insurance companies to the best of our ability. The joke we have internally is that, yeah, the technology is nothing. The insurance codes are really where the challenge lies when you are inventing a new product like this.
Dan Brzezinski, what about the Amputee Coalition? Is this a big priority?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's one of the larger aspects of our effort. We have advocacy efforts that go along with improving insurance fairness and insurance standards in all 50 states and also at the federal government level.
And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Richard in Benicia.
Hi. I was wondering, is there any research being done in learning the movements and motions of individuals before they lose a limb? I'd say for soldiers particularly, this might be useful so that he learns how you balance, how you walk, how you move, so that if you lose a limb, it's more a matter of programming a replacement limb than learning everything you do from scratch.
Scott Summit, do you want to take that?
I have heard that the soldiers are now being 3D scanned before they go into battle. They're
wow.
Doing body scans. That is for any number of reasons afterwards.
Just because they're at higher risk of potentially.
Right. Wow. Right. Exactly. So that might be one. Doing a full gait analysis, I think that's probably a great idea. There are not a lot of gait analysis centers in the country that somebody can go to, but that certainly stands to reason that we might go that direction.
Richard, thanks so much for the call. And let's now go to Jack in Pinole. Hi, Jack.
Hi. This topic is really wonderful, and it shows the potential of the intersection of the arts, crafts, and science. Some people may be aware that UC Berkeley, there has been an exoskeleton designed as part of the mechanical engineer department by a team of graduate students, and they were able to use their experience with working with hand tools and learning perspective as well as mechanical engineering aspects under Professor Cazzaruni, and were able to design a exoskeleton leg set that can address issues with the knees that has now dropped it down to below the price of an electric wheelchair. And it's through the arts that they were able to pull this all together.
Jack, thanks for sharing that. Scott or Dan, do you want to comment on the technology that Jack is talking about?
I couldn't agree more that there's a natural marriage between the arts, craft, and technology, that seeing those as individual silos really doesn't enjoy the benefits of what happens when those start becoming collaborative disciplines. And I believe what you're referring to is Cazzaruni's student's work might be exobionics, which was originally Berkeley Bionics, and it was students out of Berkeley, Russ Angold being the founder. They are off and running, so to speak.
Jack, thanks so much for the call. Dan Brzezinski, I'm curious, you know, we've talked a little bit about the different types of technologies that are out there. I'm curious what you're most excited about for the future. I mean, I read about scientists implanting brain chips into patients who are paralyzed to control artificial limbs with their own thoughts. I read a New Yorker piece about, you know, 3D printing, trying to replicate tissues and organs. I'm curious what is most exciting to you, Dan Brzezinski.
I'm excited about all of it, to be honest. There's a lot of very cool stuff coming down the pipeline. That said, getting back a little bit to my comment earlier about prices of this technology and insurance, and some of the things that Scott and Emily have mentioned as well, is that there's a bunch of amazing technology out there. The issue with the disability sector in particular, is that the populations in the grand scheme of things are actually rather small, and particularly from a business perspective, the market is tiny. Mm-hmm. If a quarter of the American population were to lose an arm or a leg tomorrow, we would have companies like Apple and Google coming out with tremendous solutions within a year, I have no doubt. The problem is the market just isn't there. I think we have about 70,000 amputations in America every year. And that's going to encompass some feet, some hands, different levels, different ages. You know, not everyone is a young athletic soldier in their early 20s. A lot of our amputees are in an elderly population, losing limbs due to diabetes and other cardiovascular diseases. And so a lot of the issue comes with, how do you monetize this? How do you incentivize the researchers? And how do you actually bring these products to market? There was a question earlier about what about, we're talking about prosthetic knees, so someone doesn't have a knee joint at all, but what about the able-bodied adults who do have a knee joint, but it's wearing out? They can't play tennis, they can't walk, they can't go to the mall anymore. There's a philosophy in the field that I think is really highlighted by a man named Hugh Hare, who runs a company called iWalk out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. It spun out of MIT and his work in biomechatronics at MIT. And Professor Hugh Hare, his philosophy is that he's designing really advanced prosthetics for amputees as a test bed, kind of like a designing for the extreme case. If you can get an amputee up and walking, then you can take that same technology, maybe streamline it, put it into a knee brace sort of structure, an exoskeleton sort of structure, and then you can attach that to an able-bodied person. And Hugh Hare's vision is, instead of commuting to work on a bicycle, able-bodied people might just throw on a small ankle brace and jog to work without getting sweaty, because the ankle brace is going to provide all the propulsion and energy that they need. And that really, in my opinion, is the key to all of this. The technology that is going to improve my life as an amputee has to be the same technology that can be commercialized for a much larger market. And that market is going to be the able-bodied average American. And so I think that's really the key, is can these companies come up with technology that applies to people with disabilities, but then can also be spun off in a more marketable solution for the greater population.
That's interesting. And then also, I feel like sort of an undercurrent that applies to a broader number of people is also just what feels like a movement towards customization, personalization, precision medicine, that kind of thing. Scott Summa, do you see that as the future?
I think there are any number of futures, and there's plenty of reason for excitement. The Enable Group, e-nable.com, they have an exciting new business model, which I think we might see more of in the future. Their goal is to help kids who can't afford hands throughout the world get hands by kids by other kids who want to help. So, for example, their model is if, for example, Doctors Without Borders is in Haiti, they can simply take measurements from a child who needs a hand, send it up into the cloud. A kid who has a 3D printer at home, perhaps in the U.S. or anywhere else in the world, might download that file, print that hand, and send it to that the person in need, the child in Haiti. So it takes the cost out of it, and it kind of crowdsources the design process. This is designed through crowdsource design. It crowdsources the manufacturing, and it really takes the cost and some of the challenges out of providing a need, providing a service for people in the world with needs.
Scott Summit, do you see yourself more as an engineer, mechanic, or do you see yourself more as a designer?
Oh, I'm an industrial designer by training, which is one foot in the engineering camp, but a true engineer would not maybe acknowledge that. And then one foot in the arts and innovation and problem solving.
And just a word or two about the significance and importance of aesthetics in this realm.
I think when you're talking about a product for a human being that is as intimately used as an assistive device or a prosthetic device of any kind, you're really only going halfway there when you meet the most fundamental utilitarian solution, that it really has to consider the totality of a person, that we are squishy things. We're emotional. We have a sense of self, a sense of self-image. And if that is not considered, the product is incomplete in one way or another.
So then, Dan, that leads me to ask you, Dan Brzezinski, what changes would you like to see in your own limbs?
Pardon me. Yeah, absolutely. I, of course, would prioritize function over form. At this point, I still have quite a lot of difficulty with walking over anything other than just the flattest, safest environment. But the fact is, I also wear these legs for all of my waking hours every single day, and they always look the same. I would love to be able to switch out the covers and the aesthetics of my legs just like I switch out my tie with every suit I wear.
Well, Dan Brzezinski, thanks for joining us. He's chairman of the Amputee Coalition. Thanks also to Scott Summit, design director for 3D Systems, and Emily Smith-Batix, assistant director of the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability. We were also joined earlier by Michael Goldfarb with the Mechanical Engineering Center and professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Vanderbilt University, and Ian Stevens with Touch Bionics. I'm Mina Kim. You can see pictures of prosthetics on our website, kqed.org/forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.